All right. So this is our second early developmental trauma-focused Q&A call for this round of SBSM. And I've got Jen Greer with me. Hey, Jen, welcome. And Mara in the chat and Susan. All right. All right. Okay, nice. I see you there, Jen. Hi. All right. So we got not a ton of questions, so we'll be able to answer all of them, which is great. And most of them were directly related to early developmental trauma. Some were not, but we'll answer them anyways. With even some of those that were not directly related, there was an indirect relation for a lot of them. So we will tie that in. So without further ado, we will get going. So this first one. Hi, Seth. Can working with old survival stress feel like a game of whack-a-mole? Once you resolve one issue, another pops up. Or is it more like the stress just transitions to a new subject? Or can it be that the original syndromes were never fully resolved? So there can be many reasons for this phenomenon. If you don't know what whack-a-mole is, an old game from when I was a kid with little guys that would pop up out of holes, and you hit one, and another one whack pops up over here, and you hit that one, and oh, they keep on popping up. So yes, sometimes it can be like this when we're doing this work. We resolve something, and then oh, here's a new thing that pops up, and there can be many reasons for this, and it's very common. One of the main things that happens is when we are living with unresolved trauma and survival physiology in our system, a lot of the time the nature of that is to be kind of locked down. The system goes into the patterns that it knows of survival, and very often it's quite rigid. And this can often lead to a consistent experience that isn't that great, where we have certain symptoms and syndromes, and they just sort of stay the same. And everything kind of just progresses at a slow pace. Things seem just kind of normalized, I guess. And but it's normal and it's survival. So it's not like ideal, but it's familiar. And very often it is consistent, not all the time, but a lot of the time. Then we start doing this work, freeze starts to lift from the system, more flow starts to come in different ways. And all of a sudden, there's change. It's a disruption to what the system knows. And so it's good, but it can lead to this experience of oh my gosh, I never felt anxiety before, and now I feel anxiety. What's up with that? Am I going backwards? It's like, no, you have sympathetic energy now available to be felt because the freeze isn't there anymore. Or there's tension that I'm feeling that I've never felt before. Or I'm having a flare up in my gut. I'm feeling heat. I'm feeling these weird sensations. And it seems like they keep on changing. That is actually normal when we start to come out of freeze a little bit and start to get more flow coming through the system. So it's actually a good thing. It's just not comfortable all the time. Now, another thing that can happen is, if we have a lot of functional freeze in our system, and say we've had many shock traumas, like say we've had many impacts to the system, many falls, injuries, that kind of thing that happened while we were frozen, those can start to pop up. And that can feel a bit like this whack-a-mole thing, like, oh my gosh, I've got this tension in my shoulder. Okay, that's resolved. Now it's in my ribs. Oh, now my legs hurt. Now I've got something happening in my pelvis. Now my neck is tight. And that is very often the result of what we call these force vectors, basically tension and force from the impacts that got stuck because we were already in freeze. And now we're thawing out, and these impacts are starting to surface. Through the system, through the tissues, very often in the fascia or in the musculature. So that is another way that that can happen. Now, the way that this relates to early developmental trauma is that this tends to happen, this kind of whack-a-mole things popping up all over, the most when the system has been in freeze for a long time. And that is the most common adaptation we see with early developmental trauma is that the system learns to recruit freeze to numb us to our experience very, very early on. Because there's so much stress in our environment, it's like, okay, that's the best option. Let's numb stuff out. Let's go more into freeze. So that's how it's related. And a final note on this is we need to be careful not to play whack-a-mole with our attention. So we don't want to focus on these things as if they are all these problems erupting out of nowhere. And then we zoom in on each one with concern and fear, right? That would be a normal response to having unfamiliar things arising, but it doesn't facilitate their processing very well. And so that's where we want to try our best to hold this intention of openness and curiosity, like, oh, how interesting. Now this thing is arising. That's weird. And that's a hard approach. It takes practice because we're wanting to do this with things that are often really uncomfortable. And we've been trained if something's uncomfortable, we need to be concerned about it. And that can be true too, right? If we injure ourselves and our body is sending us signals of pain, that's an indication that we need to take care of it. In the context of unresolved trauma, though, it's very often the things that are arising aren't actual issues in the moment that need medical attention. It's old stressors and shocks arising through the system. And so we want to try to be like, ah, I hear you. Hello. Yes. Okay. What can I do for you? How can I help? Right. So, yeah, that is it for that one. And I will pass it on over to Jen for the next one.
Thank you, Seth. And hi, everyone. I also wanted to say hi to Mara and Susan, who are here from the team. Can maybe help in the chat if you have questions that are related to what we're talking about. And I just wanted to name that I just got home a few minutes ago from, I had some family stuff this morning, so I'm sort of landing as I am. So I notice my voice is a little higher. And yeah, I'm thinking that will probably shift as we're here and we talk. So I am going to start with the first question. And the first question is, excuse me, I have a lot of anxiety, and underneath it, I have a lot of emotional turmoil going on, sadness, frustration. And it's been a real struggle to find safety, but also allow emotional expression. Crying anger to be able to get better, to get the balls out of the pool. How do I find balance between those two? So this was an interesting question because it seems very straightforward on the surface, but when I really thought about it, there's actually a lot of nuance here. And so I'm going to try and unpack it a little bit. So to start with, like a simple answer, how do I find balance between the two? It might be helpful to remember that through the lens of early developmental trauma, what most of us didn't get enough of was a regulated, attuned person or other being there when we felt these things, when we felt sadness, when we felt frustration, when we felt anger, right? And so, one of the important things that we're looking to do with this work is as we feel things as an adult, is to bring in some kind of presence, some kind of a holding container. So, one thing you can always do is to do both, right? Like, if you're just sometimes also to name, sometimes that the emotions just come out, right? We don't sort of have the ability to titrate, or we may not have any say. It's just all of a sudden we're, and there's a question like this later. We're just feeling really angry or overcome with sadness. And so something that we can always there do there is to bring in some of the basics, right? We can do things like bring in some self-touch, could be the so you can see me better. It could be the self-hold or simply just putting a hand somewhere that feels good. For me, I often like to move my hand because it lets a little bit of that sympathetic that's underneath, that's associated with those feelings. It gives it a place to go. We can feel the surface we're on, right? We can orient to safety, to the contact with the ground. and we can turn toward our resources. And if you've been to these calls before, you may have heard Seth and I or others talk about how with early experiences, often having soft things or warm things or something comforting can be helpful. And so we can be feeling these feelings while we're also, in whatever way we can, bringing in some kind of safety, care, and orientation to what's here and now, right? Because also when these feelings come, sometimes we can sort of get swept away to another time. So that would be, I think, the first and kind of most fundamental thing. The other thing is that when we're having a lot of big feelings that all come together, right, which is very common with early developmental trauma, over time, we want to develop the capacity and the awareness to be able to sort of tease them apart so we can really feel like what that sadness feels like, different to what frustration feels like, maybe even frustration different to anger, right? And so that comes with time as capacity and awareness grow. So what we do when we're not feeling things, if I know some people are feeling things all the time when they first get here, none of the time or all the time. But if there are times when you're feeling less and you can do your practices, whatever that looks like to you, then you're also growing some capacity, growing access to your system's ability to settle in the times when you're feeling more. So hopefully that was clear. Like we want to be doing these things when there's not so much going on, so we have more access when there's more going on. We can always, when we have the access to it, we can pendulate too, right? We can go back and forth between really noticing my hand on my arm, the trees out the window, maybe noticing a breath, right? And then going back to feeling my sadness and how I feel that. So we can also move back and forth between the two, titrate and pendulate. The last thing I want to tease out here is this person says, it's been a struggle to find safety, but also allow emotional expression to be able to get better to get the balls out of the pool, right? And so, what I want to remind you of is that getting the balls out of the pool is important, but especially with early developmental trauma, learning to be present, learning to orient, learning to set, create the conditions where the system can settle is, I'd say, just as important. It goes hand in hand with getting the balls out of the pool. So sometimes people are thinking like, oh, I have to get to the place where I can feel it so I can get better. But really, it's just as much, and I'll talk about this a little later in response to another question. It's just as much about learning what does it actually feel like to just be okay? What does it actually feel like to settle? So, anything you want to add there, Seth?
Nope, you got them all. That's
Okay.
everything I was thinking of. Yeah, fantastic. Awesome. All right. My next one is I have early developmental trauma, but combined with early shock trauma. It's very helpful to feel fear as stored survival stress instead of as an emotion. I need similar access to love, compassion for me or inside me. Love got manipulated or is overcoupled with manipulation. Can you think of a more biological access besides trying to show compassion for myself, which isn't working so well? Or asked in another way, what is love biologically? And also grief and innate or inner pain. Thank you. I hope this makes sense to you. For sure. It sounds like when you're relating to love at an emotional level, it came along with a lot of condition or manipulation. It was messy. There was stuff that didn't feel good that went along with it. And this makes a lot of sense to me, this idea of, well, how can I relate to self-love at a biological level? What does that even mean? What I would say is biological love, self-love at the biological level, is about authenticity. It's being our authentic self because that's what our whole being wants. At a biological level, the most fundamental way in which we do this is through following our impulses. That is truly an act of self-love, self-compassion, to hear the body's biological signals, and simply respond appropriately, which again is what we didn't get with early developmental trauma a lot of the time. So that is the most basic way that I can imagine expressing self-compassion and self-love at a biological level is to really listen and honor our impulses that arise from our physiology. Another way that this might be expressed is in boundaries. That is also a form of self-love and compassion because it's about protecting our physiological experience from influences that don't feel supportive. So, healthy boundaries with relationships and situations that are toxic and not supportive, along with really listening to and following our innate impulses that arise from the physiology. And those go hand in hand, right? Very often, it's very difficult to listen to, hear, and follow our impulses if we're in an environment where we feel like we're going to be judged for doing so. Right. So these two things go together and are very much about self-love. In terms of other feelings like grief or pain, there's can be lots of reasons for this, of course, right? Attachment rupture or all the way to physical injuries and shock traumas, like I was mentioning before. I would say the most fundamental way that these things express in the physiology is often through constriction. So, constriction in the tissues, in the fascia, and in the diaphragms. That is another big way in which pain expresses physiologically. There's a famous quote from Peter Levine, which is, pain is trapped sensation. Very often, what we're feeling as pain is not the actual thing that's wanting to happen, it's our inner constriction against it. So, we may have, for example, a lot of grief, which is often stored in the lungs, so which would be associated with the shoulder diaphragms. Right? So, say we're breathing and working with the shoulder diaphragms, and we feel this pain. Very often, that pain is a constriction that we're encountering where we've held something. As we work with our breath and our intention and bring some more space and flow into the system there, then that underlying grief may be allowed to move because the pain was us bracing against it and not actually the grief. Because grief in itself, at a pure level, is not really painful per se. Grief, biologically, when it's not being constricted against, is quite expansive. It's just really intense, right? So lots of people associate grief with like a tight throat. Tightness in the chest, maybe. That's the body bracing. When we are able to allow the grief and the pain to move through, it actually is more like a wave moving through the system. Tears, right? Sound is very useful in allowing this stuff to move. And that is intense, but it's not necessarily painful. So that's the best way I can think to answer those questions. And I'll pass it on to you, Jen, unless you have anything to add to that one.
Just one small thing. Well, maybe not quick, not small.
Yeah.
It might sometimes it's helpful, especially because there's a lot of messages out there about like loving ourselves and our inner mother and our inner parent and all that kind of stuff, right? Which can be helpful, to be clear. But sometimes if we have early developmental trauma, we didn't get experiences of that from the outside. And so it can be hard to kind of feel it on the inside. So something else that you could consider, and this fits right with what you said, Seth, is like, can I sit against a tree and feel also what it feels like biologically to kind of have the support from the outside too? Because they kind of go hand in hand. And if we don't have an external reference, it can be a little harder to find the internal one sometimes. If that's not an issue for you, then you can ignore it. But for some of us, that is a thing.
Totally, yeah, and nature is a great resource for that kind of unconditional support. Yeah, absolutely. A tree, generally speaking, isn't going anywhere. So it's like, yeah, you can rely on that support. Yeah.
For sure. Yeah, that's it. So the next question, I'm having difficulty being assertive. when somebody says something at work that's confrontational, my default is to appease. I struggle to assert my position at times. In the moment, I go blank and I automatically go to how do I avoid this confrontation? So this will even mean putting off a difficult conversation until it later blows up into a problem. So how do I work somatically with this fawning response? So again, pretty simple in the face of things, but there's a little bit to unpack here, I think. The essence of it is someone saying, at work, if something feels confrontational, I freeze and I avoid and I appease, right? And so that's the first thing I want to point out is it sounds like there's some fawning, right? As they name, some appeasing, but there's also going blank, right? So that sounds like there might be some freeze coming in, like looking to avoid the confrontation to be, and again, check this out, whoever asked the question, but it feels like, how do I get out of here? So that sounds a little bit like flight. So it actually sounds like there's a few things going on here potentially. And that can be helpful to know because of what I started to talk about in the last question is that over time, you know, these responses can come in such quick succession that they seem like the same thing. But over time, we want to tease them apart so we can really kind of, as you were saying, Seth, like listen to each one in more detail and hear what it has to say. And so it might also help to think about answering this question to think about what we do in the moment and what we do outside of the moment, right? So in the moment, we can just bring in the basics because, and first it can help to start with acceptance, right? It's understandable. If we were young and we weren't supported in asserting ourselves, or if anger wasn't safe, right? Because there is a important link between healthy aggression and the ability to assert ourselves and the ability to sort of speak from our place of authenticity, and especially to do so if we think someone is coming from a different place or it feels confrontational. So, with that said, we can think about what we do in the moment and what we do outside the moment. So, in the moment, kind of accepting that this has happened without sort of beating ourselves up and saying, why can't I? Why do I go into freeze? And why can't I stand up for myself or whatever the case, but just to kind of be like, oh, this makes sense that this is how I learned to adapt. And then to practice what we can. And sometimes just naming what's happening can be a way to bring in a little bit of observer, like, oh, I noticed that I want to say something, but I can't. I notice that I'm trying to figure out how to get out of here and what I need to say to get out of here and make the other person feel okay. So you just sort of notice. And as we're doing that, if we have the ability, we might or the capacity at the time, we might take a moment to look around, to orient as this is happening. When there's the flight and the freeze, there's also, and the appease, there's also an underlying sympathetic activation happening. So anything you can do to move, like even if you're standing there, you might have your hands at your sides and be able to move your hands a little. Or move your toes in your shoes, right? So finding just a little bit of outlet for that underlying sympathetic charge could be something to explore. So there's these little things that you can do in the moment that help over time. Another more important, no, not more important, just as important piece of this is working with it outside of when it's happening. Working with something outside of when it's happening allows us often to slow down. It often gives us the ability to titrate, to notice in more detail. And it could be an opportunity to take each piece at the time, like one, excuse me, take each piece one at a time. So I might start and notice, okay, if I just start to think about like moving towards that conversation with that person yesterday, what's the first thing I notice happening? And maybe it's something I wasn't even aware of. Maybe I noticed my gut gets tight, right? Or, you know, as Seth was saying, there's a real, if there's early developmental trauma involved, there can be a real strong tendency to constrict or to draw into oneself. So you might notice the chest or the throat getting tight. So whatever it is, though, you can take it a piece at a time and work with it in the ways that you're learning in SPSM. And that will, and that's probably something that you would want to do over time. And as you do that, and alongside the other aspects of this work, you'll probably find that in you have more options in the moment, right? So your options in the moment might slowly grow, where instead of jumping right into appeasing, you might notice you can sit back a little bit and think for a few moments before you respond. So just looking for little changes in the dynamic as you're exploring this, both inside and out of when it happens. The last thing that I want to say is that this idea of confrontation can be an important one because confrontation can feel so charged. And sometimes, if difference wasn't modeled or safe, like where how we grew up or where we grew up, then any difference of opinion can feel like confrontation. And so, something that you might be curious about is, can I tell the difference between someone just has a different view than I do, and when they're really, confrontation tends to there tends to be some fight energy usually, or just sort of like something like some healthy aggression coming in. So you might get a little curious, like, can I tell the difference between someone's just saying like, oh, I would do that differently, or can we think about that differently, and when someone's really kind of coming in and saying like, what are you doing? like we need to do this differently. I don't know what you were thinking there, Seth, So just to start to differentiate, because when everything feels like confrontation, it can make it feel more charged. It might make it feel scarier. And so starting to just bring in some differentiation there can also be can be really helpful in time. And I think that's all I had. What about you, Seth?
The only other thing
Okay.
that,
Oh,
oh, yeah.
you take the fawning piece. You can take it.
Oh, okay. Well, the only other thing I was thinking about was in terms of working with this when we're not in the experience, like Jen said, using memory can be very helpful in all the ways she talked about. And part of that can also include allowing yourself to say, what maybe wants to come out, and to understand that that might not be a like something that would be actually appropriate to say, right? If our reaction is charged and maybe not in full relation to what's actually happening, and which sounds like is going on, like this in this experience, the person is getting triggered into a fawn response, which means survival energy is present, and maybe it's not actually a survival situation, right? It may be that there's words that want to come out that actually would not be good to do in the moment, right? But could lead to a deeper discovery when done not in the moment, right? So what might those impulses be? How might you allow yourself to speak without a filter when you revisit this in memory, and how that might that connect to the source material, right? Because you may actually be wanting to tell off your dad or whoever it is, and the words that may want to come may lead you to that some more self-discovery, and also to that activation that's underneath. Like that can help be a bridge into that more sympathetic energy. And then in terms of the fawning piece in the moment, just to remember the idea of potent posture, because with fawning there is simultaneously a freeze. And we have to use freeze in order to suppress our authenticity. It's part of the subtle, nuanced way that we've learned to recruit, because we have this higher brain that can also work with these survival energies. So freeze can just be the suppression of our authenticity. That doesn't feel good. So how might we connect to our potency? And Jen mentioned maybe moving the fingers, wiggling the toes. Also, what are you doing with your posture? How might you really notice the ground under you, connect to some sense of potency and balance? And that's something that you can do pretty invisibly, right? Just another thing that you could notice. All right. Okay, how to do this healing work with a new baby? I have a 3-month-old baby and barely have any time or headspace with the exhaustion and baby brain. But I'm also really scared to not do this work because I know I need it. Especially now, I've been feeling more anxious than ever. Along with the general changes in my body, relationship, and identity, it's a lot. I'm struggling more than I think I realize, and I'm nervous that my baby husband and I are not going to come out of the first year unscathed. So the first thing I'll say is try not to focus so much on getting everything right. It sounds like there's this the whole way that you're approaching this is, oh my God, I gotta do it right now, or everyone's gonna be screwed, and the whole family, right? We're all gonna go down, right? And so that itself is a survival response, the way in which you're orienting to this situation. So try to take the pressure off a little bit. Understand that your kid is resilient, that babies can adapt and move through a lot, especially since you are doing this work. How wonderful that you have a brand new baby and you already know about all this stuff. You don't have to figure it all out right away, right? Understand that you have time and that you don't have to figure it all out. And with that being said, it's about doing the best you can when you can and sticking to the basics. The more that's going on, the less fancy we want to be, right? It may not be the time to feel like it's time to get all the balls out of the pool, like Jen was saying. This it's not maybe the time to do a lot of intense tracking of inner experience and working with diaphragms and joints and layers and really, working to find those charges and express them. Maybe not so much right now. It may be much more about how can I simply orient to the present from moment to moment? How can I use my resources to soothe and settle, use my external supports as they are available. How can I really listen to my biological impulses? And also to understand that connecting with your baby, that in and of itself can be healing for both of you. How can you drop into that wonderful biological connection that is there? And this may, like nursing is a really wonderful time to do this, and I don't know for sure if you're doing that or not, or if you can. I know it's not always possible, but if possible, if you're nursing, that can be a wonderful time, or just even if you're feeding with a bottle, that same paradigm of just being there and really tuning in to your little one and that connection that's happening while feeding is going on. That can be really powerful for both of you, those very simple moments of connection, of just feeling them on you, feeling their weight, having lots of skin-to-skin contact can be really healing for both of you. So to understand your relationship with your little one holds a lot of innate healing power in and of itself, and especially if you can sort of take the pressure off a little bit and know that you have time and have patience for yourself, right? I think that's the biggest thing. Let me see if I have anything else. Yeah, that's it. All right. Anything you want to add to that one, Jen?
Only that, just to kind of emphasize what you said about taking the pressure off, and the words that come to mind are think in terms of the long game, sort of like hopefully you'll have a very long life with this little one that your baby that you're nurturing. And so to think that, like, think in terms of more perhaps like being on a journey together and maybe reading some of the comments or looking at some of the success stories about how we deepen into this work and it grows with time. And so maybe thinking or, considering the perspective of how you could grow together over time, as opposed to like, I have to get it right now. So, or else like, everything will be horrible in the future. So, yeah, just to maybe play with different perspectives on that might feel supportive to you. Okay, so next question is, hey, Seth and Jen, my system is very slow to thaw. I've been on the healing path for over 10 years, and this is my sixth round. I've grown a lot and feel better. And yet, the change is so slow. In one of the calls on early developmental trauma, the slowness was mentioned as a possible consequence of early developmental trauma. How does EDT cause this stuckness in the system? Sometimes it really feels like I'm trying to move an immovable object. Okay. So So first of all, you say you've been on the healing path for 10 years and you're on your sixth round. So just to for all of us, I don't know what you were doing until you found this work, but it sounds like you've been doing this work for about 3 years. And you know, I had been doing other work for like, I don't know, 15 years before I found the early developmental trauma piece. And it helped in ways, but it didn't really help in the specific ways that address early developmental trauma to a great extent until I really found this work. So it might just sort of be something to think about when you're thinking about your time frame, right? Because early developmental trauma can take time to create changes, right? And I'm going to say a little bit about why, but first I want to really acknowledge that you've grown a lot and feel better. Like that's huge. Like I hear you saying it's slow, and I totally get that, relate. But the fact that you've grown and feel better, like don't underestimate that because that's saying a lot. Your system is clearly moving in order for that to happen, right? I also want to say a little bit about why early developmental trauma can take time. And first, before I say this, I want to remind us all that it's a progression, right? So when we're talking in terms of time frames and we say something like, you know, maybe you know, we might be talking about 5 years or 7 years. That doesn't mean that we stay the same and then 7 years later, like a flip switch, we flip a switch and we're sort of into a different experience. It's like things are changing all along the way, and we're just continuing to sort of oftentimes deepen into and grow those changes and discover new ways to new possibilities, right? And I was trying to think of a way to describe it, and something that came to mind is houses. For many years, I lived in an old house. It was like 120 years old, right? And when the kitchen in that old house was like, it was like from the 1950s. So it like had no dishwasher, and it had one of those refrigerators with the handle where the freezer's inside. And you would imagine after like 4 or 5 decades, it was pretty stinky. And like this linoleum floor that I don't even know what the original color was. And so there's a lot I could say there, but the part that I want to tell you is that when we got around to doing a kitchen renovation, it was a big deal because it was an old house. So the plumbing was over 100 years old. And the electric, we had, if anyone has an old house, like we have something there's something called knob and tube wiring, right? So it was like an outdated electrical system. It's like everything, right? So everything had to go. And the walls had to be torn down and the pipes had to be replaced and the electrical, right? So it was like a massive project that that required really going into the inner workings of like how the kitchen worked and replacing it and upgrading it and introducing new parts, right? And when it was done, it was like, you know, absolutely beautiful and it felt amazing. But it was a process that took a lot of time and work, right? Fast forward to a bunch of years later, I bought a townhouse that was built like 30 years ago. So it had pretty up-to-date wiring and pretty up-to-date plumbing and all the things. And it did have the original kitchen. So when I wanted to do that, it was like we didn't have to tear the walls apart. We didn't have to replace the plumbing and the wiring. We just had to sort of like take the stuff that was in the way. We had to kind of get it out of there. And then there was a nice infrastructure already existing. And then we could just sort of bring the new stuff in and there was a new kitchen, right? So the amount of work it took, the amount of time it took was dramatically different. Both cases, I went from sort of a not so great kitchen to a nice, very enjoyable kitchen, but the process was really different. And that's sort of like with early trauma, we don't have access to some of the, like, or as much access as we want to some of the systems, right? We don't sort of know what it feels like to have a new electrical system or that can take a lot of power through it, right? So we're in the process of growing that and building that, and that's what takes time. if we already had that, if we got the support for that when we were young and we come to this work, then we're doing focused more on the balls often, right? Which is the taking the things out and discovering that, oh, underneath there's already this access to settling, and there's already this access to really deepening it into connection with myself and others. And so I just wanted to really make it clear the reason for the difference, right? So it's not just sort of like, oh, this is why. Alongside that, though, what's really important is that the change is possible, right? Whenever we come to this work, we have people of all ages coming to this work and seeing change happen, right? One thing you said that I wanted to kind of like pull out a little bit is you said something like, how does EDT cause this stuckness in the system? Sometimes it really feels like I'm trying to move an immovable object. And I want to differentiate between something being slow and taking time and something being stuck, because those are different experiences. And if it really feels like something's not moving and stuck, then that might be an opportunity to get curious about what's happening there. So there's a couple of Feldenkrais principles that come to mind, and I may butcher them a little bit, so forgive me. But one idea is that we can't change what we're doing until we know what we're doing, right? So sometimes we might have the stuckness and we're just like, oh, I want to get rid of this stuckness. But we might not really know, like, well, what actually is that stuckness, right? Is there actually a whole lot of, for me, for a long time, it felt like I had a block in my chest for years. And I would just like try and like rub it out and breathe it out and, do whatever to get it out. But really, the only thing that worked eventually was listening, right? So that brings me to the next Feldenkrais principle, which is actually comes from something I think called the Weber-Fechner law, just to give credit where it's due. And it's generally the idea is that the less we do, the more we notice. And so if there's this dynamic, there may or may not be, but if there's this dynamic where there's a stuckness and I want to get rid of this, and there's stuckness and I want to get rid of it, but oh, it's not moving, then it might be time to, or there might be an opportunity to do a lot less, right? And to really notice in more detail, like what's actually happening there, So can I breathe into the area? Does it change when I explore the different SBSM practices? Do I notice it changing in any way? Or does it always sort of stay as fixed as I think it does, right? So just doing some investigation there to see what you might learn, because often, if something feels stuck, there's actually a lot of potential, like a lot of, there's a word I want there. Let me see, potential energy. I'll just say that potential energy held in that stuckness. And often less is more, because we wouldn't have held it like that for so long if there weren't something there that might require a light touch. So I think that's all I have. Do you have anything to add, Seth?
No, that's it. Yeah, it really comes down to that, like with what you said about the old house. It's like with early developmental trauma, we're not just fixing something, we're building something from scratch, often for the first time. And that leads directly to this next question, which is, hello, my question is, what does it mean to be addicted to your own stress physiology? And what, if anything, does it have to do with disorganized attachment? Why might one be addicted to their own stress physiology? Well, because it's the only thing they've ever known, right? If we learned from the get-go that this is how I must be in order to function in the world, then that is going to be what we know. And there can be a tendency to want to stick with that because it's predictable. So especially in the face of any sort of attachment wounding, including disorganized attachment, that means that attachment is not predictable. Secure attachment is not something that we can rely on. But we can sure rely on our fight flight response. We can sure rely on our freeze response, especially for the first few decades of life. Our system can function at a pretty high level by recruiting those survival responses without a lot of apparent negative consequence for quite a while. We can keep on trucking, and it can be very predictable. Like, I know how to do this. I know how to move through the world with these survival responses fueling the way. And that can be strengthened by the nature of the chemistry of survival response, right? So there's a lot of cortisol, a lot of adrenaline that maybe we are used to, and that can be quite addictive. It can be something that we really grow to depend on. And like any addiction, we tend to need more, right, in order to get the same hit. So this is why we see things like people who do ever more and more extreme activities, extreme sports, skydiving or flying, with a squirrel suit. It's like, no, I started with, with climbing up a mountain, and that was great. But now that's easy. So now I need to jump off the mountain. Okay, great. I'm paragliding. I'm jumping off the mountain. That's great. Oh wow, now I'm getting that adrenaline hit. But now I'm used to that. Oh, now I'll fly with a squirrel suit, and now that's getting me this, right? So we need more and more and more intensity in order to get that same sort of rush. And that is an addictive process, that feeling, that chemistry itself. Let me just check my notes. Yeah. So that's really it. It's dependable. There's a chemistry that encourages an addictive kind of nature. Now, how do we move out of that? It's often by allowing ourselves to experience things that are a lot more boring. So, many times people will say in this work, "Oh, it's just so boring. There's nothing, there's nothing going on." Yeah, how can you cultivate more of that? Right. So moving out of things that are thrilling can be a huge part of coming out of our addiction to the stress physiology, because what we want to do is cultivate nuance, cultivate subtlety. And that means spending time with stuff that's pretty darn boring on the surface, such as orienting to the present moment. It's like, I'm not getting any adrenaline rush from this. This sucks. Right. Okay. Yeah. Well, you may have to spend some more time in that boring territory. So. Yeah. Go ahead, Jen.
Nothing to add. Shall I
All
take
right.
the next one?
Yeah.
Except that I have to say, just on a personal note, I've been navigating some things personally, and I'm just blown away at how much easier it is than it used to be. And just to give you a simple example, I'm going to a memorial event tonight, and it's customary to bring food. And last night, I had a really long day yesterday, and I was like, oh, I'd really like to take something home baked, right? And my old me, right, would have, with my stress chemistry, would have figured out a way to do it and run to the store and been up till midnight and not gotten much sleep today, and then been later to the service this morning. And it was this whole thing. And it was like, oh, you know what? There's gonna be so much food there. They know I love them. Maybe I'll have an idea. And maybe I'll have an idea to pick something up. And then I sort of said, can I get anything? And they're like, well, we'd really love croissants and macarons. And I was like, well, I'm going by a French bakery, right? So I was able to just get them exactly what they wanted, which really meant a lot to them. So, but the connection I want to make is that there's just so much more ease. So that boring can sound like, oh man, really? I have to do boring shit. But there's also an upside to it too, at least. Like, I feel like there is.
No, that's such a good point. It's like that. It doesn't stay boring. It's boring at first because it's so unfamiliar and it's not associated with that stress chemistry. Like if you had done what you would have used to do, that would have given you all sorts of yummy adrenaline,
I don't know about the yummy part, honestly, at that point. I would have been exhausted, right? Not a lot of sleep, right? Like rushing.
Yeah, so yeah, boring leads to discovering how to be in ease. That's a great point. Yeah.
All right. So next question. So this one w perplexed me a little. So I'll be curious to see if any if anything to add, Seth. I'm an alum and I'm starting to feel a lot of anger. I'm having trouble working with it because when I feel it, I want to stay angry. I don't want to soothe. I don't want to resource. I don't want to try and come out of it. I also have severe chronic fatigue syndrome, and I know I'm not ready to move the anger yet. So I either end up staying angry and suffering the consequences, or being harsh with myself and going into a bit of freeze. So how can I work with this anger more productively? So first, I want to say that we talk a lot about titrating, and it's really such a foundational principle in this work, titration and pendulation. But sometimes, especially for those of us who've suppressed a lot of things in our life, and anger in particular, it can feel really good just to let things rip, right? So to like really full feel like, what does it feel like to really like yell or just feel that energy moving through me? And so if someone asked this question, they didn't have CFS, I would ask if they had done that and given themselves permission to sort of really let themselves be as angry as they wanted to be for as long as they wanted to be. But as this person says, it sounds like they're aware of this and have already suffered the consequences. When we have CFS, often our capacity is lower. And if we move too much sympathetic energy through the system, we can have consequences, different consequences. Most namely, we could sort of have more symptoms, and it can some and the thing about that's an aspect of this work that we can just accept that we have symptoms. With chronic fatigue, it can take longer to come back from those things. And so we want to avoid that where we can, right? So the one thing I thought I might have heard in this question is that there might be a tension between different experiences, right? Because there's this like, I want to feel my anger and I don't want to soothe, I don't want to resource, and so I don't want to come out of it. And so I wondered if there was like another experience here. Like it sounds like almost like a no or some belligerence. And or a tension between a desire like, oh yeah, it might be good for me if I could titrate a little bit, like feel this and titrate. It might help me to grow my ability to be with this anger. But there's something sort of saying, like, I don't want to do that. And so I might get a little bit curious about what's going on with that not wanting to come out, right? And you can do that without moving too much energy. You can just think about like, I don't want to come out, and just sort of see like, I don't know if there's a face, my face instinctively scrunches up, or if there's like a no, but maybe just exploring if there might be something else going on there. Another question you might ask is of like, if I didn't stay angry, then what would happen? Right? Because also sometimes if we're not angry, we might feel a lot of grief, or we might feel loneliness, or we might feel something different. So you can also come at it by asking yourself a question such as that. Like, if I didn't really need to stay angry right now, and I didn't turn to beating myself up, then what would happen? Right? It might be easier to do this, like to since there's such a strong tendency, it sounds like it might be easier to do it like we talked about earlier when it's not happening. So like, what if I think about this experience when I get angry and I don't want to titrate or resource or come out of it, I just want to stay there, and to start to see like what you notice if you do it in the imagination or you do it outside of when it's happening real time. The other thing is often when we're harsh with ourselves and we have a lot of self-judgment, that can be a form of internalized aggression or internalized anger. Because as developing humans, it's healthy to have anger and aggression and to want to like, and say no and however it wants to come out. And if that wasn't supported or encouraged, then what we learn to do developmentally is direct it to ourselves, towards ourselves, excuse me. And so again, that sort of when you notice a harshness towards yourself, you might kind of see like, okay, what if I just even like made a gesture to sort of direct that like away from me, or like blew it away or made a sound? It could be quite small, given, I don't know where on the CFS spectrum you are, but it doesn't have to be a big thing, but just sort of consciously like turning it away from directing it at yourself. And I think that's all I had. Do you want to add anything, Seth?
I think you really hit the nail on the head with having the conversation. That's the biggest thing that jumped out to me from this question is when that anger comes up, And there's that, no, I don't want to, like that, allowing, really exploring that, vocalizing that. What's the face of it, right? What's the sound of it? What are the words that want to come out? Really leaning into that, I think, is excellent. And also recognizing that this anger is life energy. As you recognize, it's your system currently doesn't have the capacity to just fully lean into it and allow it to move through that wiring. Because, like Jen was talking about with the house, maybe that wiring is still old and needs to be updated, and so that it can handle this surge. And that's part of what we do with this, the slow process of building capacity, etc. But it is life energy. It is. So, how can you relate to it as that? How might you, instead of only relating it to, as like, oh, I'm so angry and I want to stay angry, how might it also be, I'm feeling so much energy. I'm feeling all this life, this that wants to come out, and I'm noticing I really want to stay connected to that. And of course, that would make so much sense, especially with CFS, right? It's a big surge. How, potentially exciting to feel that. It's just you don't yet have the ability to fully mobilize it. So just recognizing it as such, and then how might you explore little mobilizations, little bits, and that kind of conversation with yourself that Jen was talking about can be part of that. And it may also come along with very simple expression, right? Instead of necessarily thinking, well, I either have to just let it really mobilize fully, or I have to suppress it. Right? No, not necessarily. Maybe there's a little bit of a middle ground you can start to explore. Like maybe you just, yeah, squeeze the fists a little bit and do a little, and then that's it. And a little mobilization, like tiny bit, that could be potentially interesting to notice and to work with. Okay. Another thing related to anger. Can I do the towel exercise or any of the healthy aggression exercises in front of my children? Sometimes when I'm angry, which is most of the time, happens when my kids are around. I feel the urge to yell, not really at them, but just around. So I think maybe healthy aggression exercises will help. Since our house is small, the kids will obviously hear. I do not want them to be afraid. How to show them what healthy aggression is about. So this. It really depends on the age of the kids. It's entirely dependent on that. You really do not want to move aggression and do these practices around young kids. They don't have the ability to understand it, and they'll feel the intensity of it. And instead of providing a good model for them, what will happen is they will then probably re think that they need to take care of you on some level. It may be scary for them. And so, okay, God, that was intense and scary. How do I need to be so that dad doesn't get angry, and doesn't do that thing that scared me? And then you start this paradigm where the kids are trying to be the emotional caretakers of the parent. And along with that, they will get scared of anger, most likely. So that is if kids are young. So it depends. There's no exact age that I can nail down because kids are different in how they evolve. But generally speaking, you want kids to have a pretty secure sense of identity and self and differentiation before it would be safe to really sort of talk about this with them and do it around them. So I mean, that could be anywhere between like 12, 13, up to 18. It depends on their maturity, what they've been through. Their story, right? But they would want to be pretty secure in themselves, not have a lot of issues themselves, be pretty regulated before you would want to sort of involve them with that. That being said, there's a lot you can do with younger kids with play that is not overt aggression. Now, this may be hard if you're feeling a lot of anger yourself. So again, th this is something to bring in maybe when you're not at that sort of peak frustration, anger. But like, how can you start to bring big, sort of aggressive energy in playful ways with your kids. And I've talked about this a lot on many calls, but there's all sorts of ways to do it. You know, it depends on how old the kids are, what's their connection to their imagination. Are they of an age where they, you know, are totally excited about the idea of let's play dinosaurs and or let's be Godzilla and let's build a block village and then let's stomp it down or let's breathe fire or let's make sounds like big lions make or whatever it is, right? There's all sorts of ways to be playful with big sympathetic energy. The whole thing of like, I bet you can't push me over and you're standing in front of your bed and you let your kids push on you and you, oh, you fall down on the bed. You won, you got me. You know, this is a way of helping them connect to their aggression, to allow it to move in healthy ways. And it also is for you as well, allowing that big sympathetic energy to be present in a playful way. In terms of in the moment, though, when you're feeling this anger, it sounds like, yeah, your kids are poking on your system, which is, of course, absolutely normal. It's not about them, and that's good that you don't feel an urge to scream at them, but you do feel this urge to scream coming out. You gotta contain it the best you can and take yourself away. And just do your best to allow it to mobilize in a way that's not going to scare them. So I mean, you can do a lot relatively silently. I hear you, your house is small, but everyone's got a bathroom and they can close the door, and maybe you just work with a towel there, and maybe it's just a little like a little quiet growl that you allow to mobilize through your chest, and you focus on the effort in the arms and thinking about allowing the energy to move, feel the heat, etc. Pushing against a wall or pushing against a pillow on a wall can be part of that. Pushing with your legs. Maybe you just do like a bunch of like squats and get the blood moving through your legs, right? Using the musculature associated with those sympathetic responses. And Jen, I think we should take a little pause, but do you have anything to add to that before we have a little pause?
Nope, I'm ready for a pause.
Okay, so we're just going to take a little tea, water, bathroom break, etc. It is 11:01, so back here by 11:05, and we will finish up.
All right.
Alrighty, welcome back. So this next one is also for me. Every time I leave home, specifically my mom, my body collapses. I become catatonic and unable to function. It's debilitating. I have a sense this is connected to early developmental trauma and early separation from my mom. I'm still not understanding why we don't need to know what happened to us in order to heal. How and why specifically through this work does this response no longer take over? So in terms of the force part, yes, that's something you'll often hear us say, that when we're working this way somatically, physiologically with the nervous system, you don't have to know what happened cognitively in order to change it. The reason why that is because we're not working with the story, we're working with the physiology in the moment. And we can work physiologically without knowing cognitively what happened. That being said, we're not saying that meaning is unimportant. Meaning is a part of the human experience that's very important. It's just that that's not our way in with this work. It could be, but generally speaking, we're working physiologically. And with early developmental trauma, there may be no memory or content. And all we have is the physiology in order to work with. So, working physiologically in the moment is what allows us to find different pathways and different outcomes. Through that process, meaning can arise. So, it may be that you've come to the meaning that, oh, this is about my early separation from my mom. Great. That's totally important. However, the way that you work with this work so that the response no longer takes over is not by understanding the story so much, it's by what happens in your physiology and how can you find something else? How can you work with that and find different possibilities, different outcomes, different ways to connect and resource? So it sounds like what's going on is physiologically, when you leave home, specifically your mom, freeze takes over. And that would make total sense with what you're describing. It sounds like there may have been a rupture with attachment early on that was really terrifying. And so this freeze response is still entrained and it takes over. So we need to work in the moment with that. When that's arising. And it sounds like it's a total collapse, essentially. So the first and foremost thing is, how can you spend time with that collapse in a way that is kind and attuned and caring? Right? All the stuff that would have been missing during that rupture when you would have felt so alone. How can you start to connect to yourself in a way that supports the system realizing, hey, someone is here. Someone is here and paying attention. And we can do that for ourselves in the way that we pay attention to ourselves, which is with that kind, compassionate listening, right? I'm here. I'm with you. And using containment may be a big part of that self-hold, connection, orienting, feeling the surfaces you're on, maybe just allowing a little sound to start to come. Because the other thing that we want to do in these moments is, once we are able to just be with it, be with the collapse, how can we start to gently stimulate the contrary systems, which means the ventral vagal system and the sympathetic system are the systems that are sort of contrary to that collapse state. And I would probably lean towards starting with the ventral. So that may mean listening to music, or making your own sounds, playing music if you're a musician, or even have access to a simple drum or something, or just allowing a little tone to come out of the system. What's the sound of the collapse? What's the sound of the grief that you may be feeling? And of course, we don't want to go into big catharsis either, right? So feeling just, it could be as simple as like, oh, here's that thing. Okay, I'm just gonna really connect. And notice this, I'm here, I'm feeling my touch, I'm feeling my layers. Oh. Oh. and just feel the vibration of those little sounds in your body. That's how we would start to work with this and recognize that there is almost certainly a really big fear charge that is eventually likely to come out. Some kind of big sympathetic is underneath the collapse, invariably. So that is what we want to gently work our way towards feeling and having the capacity to feel. Jen?
The one quick thing I would add, Seth, is just that it can really take time. Like body time is slower than mind time, and especially when something, if you think about learning anything new, it takes time, right? And so the more I do the work, the more I really find that giving ourselves time to move in the direction of settling and know it can really take time. Can make a big difference, I guess, is the one thing.
Well, and that's part of that, the way in which we pay attention, right? It's like allowing for the time. Allow.
It goes a little bit back to what you were saying about the boringness, though, right? It's like
Yeah.
it can be so unfamiliar to be like, oh, you mean I just have to squeeze my arm and look out the window and
That's
oh, 10 times or whatever?
Yep.
Okay. Ready for the next one?
Yep, go ahead.
Okay. So this actually is a little related to a question that popped in the chat, which is that I have a big problem with bursts of rage and hatred towards my mother that come over me on a regular basis. I just go for a walk or I watch a movie, and all of a sudden I find myself screaming at her or I argue with her about the same old shit, sometimes in my head, but sometimes out loud so that people around me notice. I have no chance to slow anything down or notice how it builds up as it's just there within a second. I've annihilated her a dozen times and it doesn't stop occurring. Okay. So first thing I want to start with, there's a the, start with the end here. I've annihilated her a dozen times and it doesn't stop occurring. So the first question I would ask is, okay, it hasn't stopped, but has it changed? Right? Because with these patterns, especially that involve family and go way back to when we were very, very young, the change often happens in layers, right? It happens over time. Sometimes it's quite subtle. So the first thing, just before I say the rest, is to look and to notice, like, is anything different? Because that tells us that, oh, something is actually changing. Maybe there's more that I want to consider. Maybe there's other things I want to do, but there is something happening here. Right. If you notice, like, no, really, it's not changing, it's like the same thing over and over, right? Then that's often a clue that we may need more capacity, right? For what's happening. We may need more capacity and awareness to be with what wants to happen. And we may also, and sometimes there's also something else that wants to happen that we're sort of blowing by. Right. So those are kind of two things that I think about when, like, oh, this is happening, doing these things, I'm yelling, oh, I'm annihilating and nothing's changing. Then okay, let's step back and get curious. Right. I hear too, though, that it's spiking quickly. So I think of this as a spike. There's like a big sympathetic spike that just kind of comes out of nowhere. Right. So similar to what we talked about earlier, we can think in terms of what we can do when it's happening and what we can do outside of when it's happening, and the two support each other. So when it's happening, we can name what's happening. We can notice what we can, right? Like, oh, I notice I feel so angry. I want to like tear, so I don't want to tear my mother apart, right? And then just like, but can I actually like start to squeeze my arm, right? Or bring in some self-touch while I'm feeling so angry and wanting to tear my mother apart? Can I notice that, like, oh, I'm walking on a dirt trail right now while I'm so angry and wanting to annihilate my mom? Can I like notice anything, right? So bringing in those things just to kind of bring in some that holding container, some safety and attunement to be there alongside that experience that's happening. The other thing we can do is we can work with it outside of when it's happening, as we've already talked about this a little bit today, And so that might be in the imagination. So when it's not happening, like, what if I just like, let's say, like right now I'm outside of Philadelphia. What happens if I imagine my mother in New Zealand, right? Like, what's the first thing that I notice starting to happen? Like, can I start to notice that? Because I might notice, like, oh, actually, I feel some tightening in my heart, right? Before that spike of anger comes. Or maybe there's something that happens before the anger, or maybe I can just notice the anger in a more titrated way. You might hear us sometimes talk about prodromals. It's like the thing that happens before the thing. And so if you this could apply here, where you're looking for like, well, what actually happens before that big spike of anger happens, or what's the first sign that that big spike of anger is about to happen, right? And so working outside of when it's happening hopefully will also give you some more ability to titrate and to notice in more detail and to work in different ways. And then of course, like as you're taking steps to grow capacity and awareness more generally, that will also help with both how you the possibilities you have in the moment and how you might work with it outside of the moment in the imagination, for example. Anything else there, Seth?
Yeah, a couple of things. Sometimes when we have this kind of a thing occurring, and yeah, it's like I've done the annihilation practices, but it keeps on happening. Sometimes what that tells me is that we may not be staying connected to ourself as we're going into that work, because that's why the annihilation work is so advanced, because it's not just about visualizing and mobilizing those huge sadistic urges. It's at about also at the same time staying present with the internal felt sense and the environment. All of those things have to be happening at the same time. So if we just go into the urge to destroy, that can actually just lead to nothing if we're not staying connected to the other elements of our experience, which is connects what you were saying, Jen, about like, well, can I just feel this and connect to the dirt I'm walking on and feel my edges and just notice that I'm here? So that's my hunch, is that perhaps during these annihilation practices that you're actually coming out of yourself. You're not fully staying connected in yourself and the environment. Also, another thing to consider as a possibility, sometimes when there is this huge rage that doesn't like that, and even if maybe you are doing the annihilation work and staying connected to yourself, that can be because something else actually needs to happen, like Jen was mentioning, which may be actually you just don't feel safe in the world, right? If you think about a vicious animal trapped in a corner, lashing out at everyone that comes near, well, why is it doing that? Fundamentally, it's because it's terrified. It's not, so the anger is a response to the fact that it's terrified. So it may be that actually there needs to be more capacity built and more of a baseline sense of like a little bit more safety before that annihilation practice can be really effective. Also, sometimes in these cases, it can be useful to do a few sessions one-on-one with a provider. Because they can help us slow down, and they may notice if we're not connected to ourselves, and can help us titrate that process such that it's more integrative, more connected to all of our experience.
And
Ready.
can I just throw in there that doing the suggestions like slowing down, working with it outside of when it's happening will give you more access to what Seth is talking about, right? Like if it's not actually happening and there's less going on, then there's a greater likelihood I can stay connected to myself. There's a
Absolutely.
greater likelihood I can just work with a little bit of the movement instead of like the whole movement, right? And listen more to the impulse instead of just getting swept away by this big, like, I gotta destroy something. So yeah, that the
Yep.
two, they go hand in hand.
Absolutely. Okay. As I'm becoming more aware of my emotions, I notice that I lean towards pride and shame. What do you have to say about pride and shame? What are usually the causes? Now that I'm more aware, I'm very aware about my pride and shame, super ego. I'm aware that I cannot think myself out of it because those are living in my physiology currently. I have the instinct that if I keep practicing our work here, these things will eventually fade away. I would like to have some insights on adequate focus for me to work with these challenges. Okay, so what do you have to say about pride and shame? Well, this really, you don't mention early developmental trauma, but this definitely can connect to that because what's going on if we're in either pride or shame, well, those are two sides of the same coin, right? And both of them show a lack of connection to authenticity and our deep knowing of ourself, right? These are sort of constructs. So the shame is a toxic imprint, and then pride is like an inflated response to that, where it's like that I'm countering the shame by sort of puffing myself up. Right, but neither of them, both of those are survival adaptations, essentially, or the result of an imprint, rather. So you may have gotten a lot of toxic shame as you were a kid, and then the way that you handled that is by developing the sense of pride. But both of those are part of the same continuum. So pride is different than knowing yourself, than having confidence and a sense of your authenticity and your true nature. It's sort of a compensation for the lack of that. And that can easily happen with early developmental trauma. So the resolution is authenticity. And so I think you're absolutely right when you say, I have the instinct that if I keep practicing at work, they will eventually fade away. Absolutely. I think that these are adaptations that will fade or imprints that will fade as you continue to do this work. And remember, it's about building relationship to yourself, and it's a slow process. But every single practice that we're doing in here, all the neurosensory exercises are about building our relationship with ourself in all these multiple ways, whether that be through how we notice the environment, how we notice our inner experience, how we notice our resources and what they do for us. It's all about learning more about ourselves and building that connection to ourselves and tuning to ourselves. And that builds our authenticity. Following our impulses builds our authenticity. So that's definitely the high level sort of answer. In terms of working with the shame itself, that also could be really important. And I'll refer again to, if you haven't watched it, the shame and toxic shame and disgust video that Irene has on YouTube. But essentially, it's about working with disgust as a doorway to allowing that toxic shame to come out and be expressed and move through the system. Because it doesn't feel good to hold that stuff. It can feel, there can be a sense of just, ugh, it's like a rotten thing in the belly that we're holding. And so, how can we work with the affect, the energy of disgust? And again, without it being big and cathartic, it may start as simply as just noticing the connection between the mouth and the stomach and being aware of this physiology here and sort of holding it. And maybe you feel like a little sicky sense of that shame. And okay, well, maybe like you start to explore the affect of how that feels or the sound of how that feels. Eventually, it can lead to this just like full sort of purging. There can be the sort of energetic vomiting that happens. It's very, very common, where you're not actually throwing up, but it feels kind of like that. And it's just this, ugh, this energy coming out. It can almost be like a dry heave even. And that is often how we connect to the release of that shame imprint, which is the pride is a, just a, an adaptation to, essentially. Also exploring things like potent posture, healthy aggression, etc. These are part of emerging from the toxic shame imprint. Alrighty. Over to you, Jen.
I think you have the next one, Seth, don't you?
But do I?
EMFs.
Oh, and then do you want to finish with this is the fourth
Well,
or fifth?
I had that there was the EMFs, and then I had one, and then you had another one, I thought.
Oh, uh-oh, did I miss one? You have the one about the guitar, yeah?
Yep, I do. There was a okay, I see where you are. All right.
Oh, okay.
I had the EMFs one before, but as you have another.
Ah, got it.
Okay.
Okay.
So I'll go ahead. So
Okay.
this is my fourth or fifth course. I have difficulty retaining what I learn. So let me see where I am here. For example, I've been trying to learn to play the guitar for over 40 years, but I can't get past a few chords. I try and learn language online and I can't retain it. I think I've been in very deep functional freeze all my life. I remain too frozen, anxious to progress with the course, yet I need to. I'm running out of time to heal. Help. Okay. So, excuse me. First of all, it does sound like just the sympathetic system might be like poking its head up a little bit, right? Because you're saying, like, oh, I feel like I'm running out of time. Help. And so that can feel quite stressful sometimes, but it might also be an opportunity to be curious. Oh, like, what does that feel like? Does that feel like a different experience that when I'm in freeze and don't want to move, right? So that's just one thought there to start at the end. And then the next is to start small and know that every step matters, right? Sometimes when we feel like, oh, help, I've got to do it, I'm running out of time, it feels like we have to do something big, when in fact, what we need to do is something small. Just to start, just to bring in a little support to the system. Sorry that I'm trying to move the light, but it's got to, there we go. To bring in a little support for the system, to bring in a little stimulus for the system, right? So sometimes people take one practice or one habit and they just do that for a while. So that might look like, some like the four simple steps to calm overwhelm practice. Sometimes people just do that over and over for a while. Tense and relax. The containment practices, like some of those practices that really kind of start to just really invite some offer support to the system and gentle awareness, right? Small habits can be some simple things like just getting the habit of wiggling your toes or your fingers. Like, believe it or not, doing that regularly can make a big difference over time. Sometimes if the exhale is accessible for people, just like every now and then, like breathing out while you're orienting, just because that might invite a little bit of that parasympathetic system to kick in. The containment is a practice, but it can also be a habit. Like you're just watching TV or whatever you do when you're checking out and freeze, you're just sort of offering yourself a little bit of self-touch or a little bit of squeezes, right? So the general idea, just to bring it back to the simplicity, is to know that even though our mind might say, this isn't enough, right? I got to change now. What's it going to do if I wiggle my toes? To really kind of bring in that broader perspective, bring in the education to say, no, when I've been frozen for 40 years, if I try and change too much too fast, my system's probably going to say, like, nope, I'm staying where I am, right? But if we bring in these like little stimulus, these little supports, then we can start to like move the dial, and that does add up over time and can become exponential. The other thing is that when something's really hard to do ourselves, it might be helpful to find a way to co-regulate. And so that could be co-regulating with nature. It could be co-regulating with it sounds like you like music, like listening to music. With an audiobook or a TV show, right? There's lots of ways. If it's an option to work with a practitioner, it might be helpful to do a few sessions just to kind of also get that co-regulation and get a little bit of like insight, like a little more insight into what might be going on. One more thing, when it's hard to move, hard to engage, sometimes structure helps. So structure is a form of containment, right? So that might be a practitioner would do that. Finding a buddy, an SBSM to meet with like once a week could do that. Saying I'm going to do something for 5 minutes each day, right? That also could be a form of structure because it like makes it very con it takes it from, oh no, I have to do something. It's been all this time and how am I going to change this? It takes it from that to something specific and concrete. Right. So those are some, don't try and do all those things, but maybe see which feels most accessible to you. The other thing I want to mention is that if you haven't checked them out already, the early trauma tips and the question, the FAQ about the practices that are good for early trauma might be worth checking out. But again, that could feel like too much, overwhelming. So you might just pick one thing, right? So that's kind of why I want to keep coming back to that. Like, pick one thing, start small, start somewhere. The one other thing I want to offer, though, is that for sure, I have no doubt that regulation will be helpful with this over time, right? It gives us access to the systems that support learning. But the other thing to consider is that sometimes there might be other influences that could help to look into. And so, for example, like I've discovered that post-concussion syndrome is contributing to my CFS, and working with that's been really helpful. And oftentimes we're finding out more that, like, we think hits to head aren't a big deal, but they can have lasting repercussions. And there's actually, I don't know if you got the link, Mara, but there's, or Susan, but there's a Feldenkrais series right now about working with concussions, and they have a free lesson in there as part of that series. So if that speaks to you or anyone who's listening, you could check that out. There's lots of other ways to work with head injury, but that's just one that's very compatible with SBSM. And then the other thing is also, if it's an option to see someone like a naturopath, just to rule out that there might be something biochemical, right? Like, you could have some kind of, like, maybe thyroid can be really low and contribute to brain fog, right? That's more common in women than men, but it just be could be something to consider if, when something's been really long-standing and not a lot has changed it. So it often can help to take a multidimensional approach. So yeah. So would you add anything there, Seth?
The only thing that comes to me with this question is if it just sparks up in me the urge to reiterate that this work is not just about doing the audio lessons, right? It's the audio lessons are about learning different ways of relating to ourselves, right? And the purpose of them is to internalize them and to use them when we're not listening to the audio lesson. So this connects with to what Jen was saying is like pick one thing, really internalize it, and use it in real time, not just as part of something that you're doing with an audio lesson. And that's true of for everybody with all the work. It's about learning a language, like Irene talks about so much. And then it's like, yeah, we don't have to go to the thesaurus once we learn it. We just know it and we can improvise in real time with our system. Like, oh, I realize I'm feeling constriction in here and I probably should bring a little expansion to this diaphragm and maybe listen to my impulses about what may want to express in this area of my body. And understanding that that is something that we do, not just listening to the instructions, right? It's something that we want to internalize. So when in the case, when it feels like I can't learn anything, I can't say, okay, yeah, pick one thing. And really focus on how you can integrate it moment to moment, day by day in your life. And that is, speaking as a musician, that can apply to guitar as well, right? Like, okay, maybe you only know a few chords. Well, cool. Work with those chords. Just work with those. And how can you find different ways to strum? Or maybe you practice finger picking just with those chords. Or what might happen if you take, maybe you know a G. Just slide that G up the neck. What happens? Oh, you've got a different chord. So I'm not speaking specifically to guitar, but there's ways in which you can work within your limitations to find options, right? So, and that approach can apply to anything. All right, last question. Hi, Seth. Not sure if this is an appropriate question for the November 7th call, but I would appreciate it if you could answer it. This is my sixth round. And thankfully, I'm experiencing much more regulation. Woohoo! Unfortunately, with that, my sensitivity to non-native EMFs has increased exponentially. I continue to do the work so that I have more capacity to take it in, and I'm wondering if you have any thought on this. So, this actually does relate to EDT because this kind of hypersensitivity, where we can really feel non-native EMFs, that is very often rooted in early developmental trauma because a common adaptation with early developmental trauma is that our sensitivity and our empathy get coupled with survival energy. So there is a hypervigilant empathy, one might say, where that was one that I did, where I'm always feeling into everyone around me, so I know what they're feeling, so I know how I have to be so that I can stay safe. And that is a normal adaptation. That kind of hypersensitivity, hyper awareness can extend to things like being very sensitive to electromagnetic fields, to chemicals, right, to that kind of stuff. So, I totally relate to this question. I also am someone who has been hypersensitive to various things, which is part of why I lived in the woods for so long. I literally couldn't handle a city. It was just way too much on my system. Then I moved to Vancouver, started doing the trauma work, progressed through 7 years of work into being regulated. Now I am able to handle the city. However, my sensitivity also increased a lot. And eventually I realized, you know what? I just don't want to anymore. I can process it, but it's something I'm constantly having to deal with, and I'm always noticing the density of these electromagnetic fields. And yeah, we moved. Irene also had a similar thing. We both got more sensitive to non-native EMFs as we got more regulated. And what that has to do with, I think, is we have less tolerance for things that actually aren't good for us. And that includes relationships, and that includes toxins in our food, artificial scents. I mean, we are constantly bombarded by toxicity in this world on many, many, many levels. You have to work hard not to be poisoned. So that is something that you will have less and less tolerance for as you get more regulated and connected to yourself because you're feeling your physiology accurately and sensing the impact, right? So, what to do? Yes, you will continue to have more capacity, but it may be that you move, or it may be that you consider your environment and you have a live in a more rural area if possible. There also are products that you can buy that do help in my experience and Irene's experience as well. We use several of these products ourselves. These are sort of part of an emerging field called quantum technology. There are a lot of products out there that are nonsense, that don't do anything, and we've purchased a lot of those and realized, oh, nope, these don't work. But we have found some that actually are really good and that we feel do work. And it's not only that we feel they work, these products actually have scientific lab testing where they measure the blood cells. Oh, sorry, I've got a big truck coming by. Where they measure like the effect of non-native EMFs on blood cells under a microscope. And the blood cell is a very good indicator of the effect of non-native EMFs because it behaves differently and changes shape under that influence. So this company, which I'm going to recommend, which we're not affiliated with in any way, is called Leela Q. And I have the link here, which I will pop in the chat. And of course, it will be on the replay. Just one moment. So this company makes what's called the non-native EMF harmonizing devices. I don't understand how they work. Essentially, what they do is they don't cancel out non-native EMFs, they harmonize them such that they are more they work with the human field. They basically translate them into more like a natural EMF signal. And there are you can if you go to the site, you can see all the different lab tests they do showing the effects and the way that it works. They have lots of different products. We have the Infinity Block in our home, and we noticed right away quite a difference in how we felt when we brought that in. They also make clothing, which you can wear as you go through the world, which does a similar thing. They have all sorts of products. It's not cheap either. So just that they have quite a scale of stuff you can buy, a lot of which is quite affordable, or at least relatively. So that's just something to consider as an external support. And also know that, yeah, what you're experiencing, me and Irene also experienced. And we actually, yeah, that's part of the reason we moved to the country, is because we were like, wow, yeah, our systems are too sensitive. And it does make things like traveling, we can certainly do it, but we really notice, like we go through an airport and you go by the through the duty with all the perfumes. It's like, Jesus, that's just, it's like an assault on the system. And that's not because we're traumatized, it's because we're accurately sensing what this shit does to you. So yeah, it's part of the burden of being regulated and sensitive in a world that doesn't support that right now. So, alrighty, that is it. Unless you got anything to add, Jen?
Nope. Oh, actually, just one, Seth.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes that it's not always like what you said. Sometimes it just comes with doing the work, the sensitivity. But also sometimes when people don't have that energetic boundary, the healthy aggression work, like the VUWA, and we're really sort of bringing the arms around us with the ah, it can actually help to strengthen our energetic boundary. And sometimes that can be helpful with aspects of this.
Absolutely. Yep. And that also, we may have like a, we may be having a constriction in the tissues as a response to the non-native EMF that isn't necessary. Right. And so that sort of working with healthy aggression and boundaries and stuff can be part of at least, yeah, it may be feeling the impact, but we don't have to constrict and brace against it, because that actually decreases our fortitude. Yeah, someone asked, does that sensitivity include Wi-Fi? Yeah, that's what we're talking about. Wi-Fi, just the electromagnetic fields that come from electric grids, are very dense in cities. High voltage power lines, that type of stuff. Yeah, there's all sorts of non-native EMS. Microwave ovens. Oh my God, turn a microwave on and like I can feel it from 20 feet away, there's earbuds, the wireless earbuds, really not good. That's like little microwave ovens sitting in your ears. All these things, yeah, not the best. Phones,
Just curious, do you know if underground power lines are better than
way
above ground?
better, way better. Yeah, that's one thing that Europe really has on us. They figured out to bury that stuff, and it's way better when it's underground, because yeah, the ground has a neutralizing effect. Yeah.
Thanks.
All right.
All right.
Thanks all.
Thank you.
Great to see you as always. Thanks, Jen. Thanks, Mara. Thanks, Susan. Bye for now.